You are listening to KDVS 90.3 FM. It is Tuesday at 5 o'clock, so it is time for office hour. Before we begin, I want to remind you that the views contained in this show may not reflect the views of KDVS, the KDVS sponsors, or the University of California. This is Professor Jay, otherwise known as Naomi Janowitz, and as we do every Tuesday at 5, we go out and we knock on the door of some office building here on this beautiful campus. Can you hear me knocking there? And we find out, what are all these people doing on this campus? What's happening in all of these offices? What are people studying? What are they thinking about? And I'm extremely pleased. I replaced my Bach, which I usually start the show with composition by our guest today. So today we are going to go into the realm of music composition and the work of my friend Pablo Ortiz. So first we want to say welcome, Pablo.
Thank you very much.
Right. So we'll be playing excerpts. That was one excerpt from a composition of his, and we have some more that you can also always, as always, listen to once the show is archived. And you get a chance just to give a quick advertisement. This Saturday night, they're being performed live.
Yes. Actually, I have two pieces this week, which is very unusual. One is at a noon concert. It's a string trio at Pitzer Hall. And the other one is a bandoneon concerto, which happens at Mondavi
on Saturday
at 7 p.m. 7 p.m. is, you know, the key thing that people have to remember, because there are lots of shows that happen at 8.
So. Okay. So that's why we mentioned it at the top of the hour, and we'll return to that later. So 7
Great.
O'clock on Saturday, some of the things we're talking about on the show today, you'll be able to hear in person. But as always, before we begin delving into research and products that the person has developed, we always ask the question about how they got to where they got to. And I think this is a really interesting question today, because not every person just wakes up one day and says, I want to be a composer. It just seems like a somewhat of an unlikely thing. So how did you become a composer, Pablo?
Well, when I was about 5, one of my uncles, who had gone on a long trip to Europe, came to our house with a suitcase, and he, you know, took an accordion out of a suitcase and gave it to me. So I guess that was my first. It was my first instrument. I played for about 2 years
on the accordion.
On the accordion, and then I started playing the piano. My mother played the piano. So I guess I was never very good at playing. But I was really interested in modifying the things that I was playing.
Uh-huh.
So I was never really good at repeating things, you know, thousands of times to get them perfect. I tried. When I was 17, I tried for a year.
Still the piano?
Yeah, to become a pianist. And, it wasn't very efficient. You know, I was... It took me a lot of work to be mediocre.
You know what? You're not alone in that. There's a lot of mediocre people playing the piano trying very hard. But this is an interesting solution to those of you out there who may be feeling you're mediocre on your instrument.
Yeah.
That become a composer instead.
Yeah. Well, also, it's, I guess, you know, you always think that you could have been anything, and
when you're young, you
when
mean?
You're young, yes. When you're older, maybe too. You know, like I could have taken all of these different directions in my life. I think it's a good way of telling stories without having to tell the actual stories. You know, I guess one of the reasons why I became a composer was that maybe I was afraid to be a writer. You know, and. You know, being a composer kind of helps you, because you're shielded by a, an abstract curtain. The music is, you're telling stories, but it's still an abstract thing. So, and, you know, you can conceive all these, you know, forms in time, but you don't have to, you know, deal with characters or, you know,
Or spelling.
Spelling or specific ideas, political or otherwise, you know. I mean, uh-huh. It's like, you know, it's a kind of a safe space in a way.
Hmm. But so by the time we left you at 18, yeah, or 17, 18, as an unfulfilled piano player, you already knew you wanted to be a composer young?
I think I did, yes.
Hmm. Yeah. So you go off, somebody wants to become a composer, you go to undergraduate and then you go to composer school, or?
Well, I had a kind of a strange trajectory. I went to, you know, in my country at that time, you know, things were complicated. Mm. So I left the country for a couple of years. I went to Europe. I continued to practice on the piano. I lived in Barcelona for a while. At that point, I really became convinced that I wanted to be a composer. So I went back to Argentina and I went to the university there. Mm. It was like an undergraduate program, but specifically on composition. Mm. And after that, I you know, took a few years off. I did some interesting projects. I was like music for theater. I wrote music for a couple of films. Hmm. And then I went to Columbia University in New York and I did my graduate work there.
In composition.
In composition, right. Yes.
Uh-huh. Terrific. Well, I'm sure we will come back to this question of composition many, many times in the show. What interests me that you can help us, besides listening to your pieces, many of which are just wonderful, and I was listened to them many times getting ready for today. I think in general, it's not always easy for people to approach new music. And I'm wondering if you can give us some guidance as we begin to turn to thinking about the particular pieces you've written and listen to them and then talk about them and think about how you wrote them. How can we help people sort of approach new music? And what is new music? And one way, it's just music they never heard before.
Yes.
You know, I think can often be difficult for people. And I think also just new music in general. If you look at the vast array of types of things that are styles now in music and all the different forms that there are, it's, I think, sometimes bewildering or just complicated. And students have asked me this, you know, how to, in the same way we've talked with artists about going to an art museum with modern art and trying to think about how to be a good audience. So if you were telling somebody, now we're about to listen to your music, what would you say to them about how to approach listening?
Well, we're extremely lucky because, you know, of that sort of eclectic approach, you know, that we are we have been handed a time in history where there are millions of different options, and all of these options are possible. So what I would tell people is to be open-minded and to try to listen, you know, to things at face value. But what I'm trying to say is today I could, new music in general is music that is being produced and created and mm-hmm. performed, you know, in our time. You know, it's contemporary music essentially. But there's so much of that. And, you know, at some point at the beginning and, you know, well through, you know, the middle of the 20th century, there was this idea that new music was this extremely difficult to listen, sort of, you know, hard and
obscure, dark,
yes. And, you know, and there is a lot of music in the 20th century that is like that. And, you know, the source of that is, you know, late German Romanticism. Now I'm focusing on Western music.
Right.
Which is one of millions of possible musics that are being, you know, produced and created and performed contemporarily. So there was this German Romanticism, which was one kind of line in history, but it was kind of understood as being the line, you know. There's this conception of linear history where one thing comes after the next and mm-hmm. so on. Mm-hmm. And after that came the second Viennese school, which is, you know, Schoenberg and Webern and Berg. And after that came, you know, serialism, and after that came, you know, total serialism, and after that came, you know, people like Boulez and people like John Cage and so on and so forth. So all of these things were hard to listen to, and they demanded a tremendous intellectual effort, pretty much like, you know, abstract expressionism, or, you know, like all these, you know, different sort of successive periods in visual arts. There's a great story. There was this guy called Slonimsky, you know, who
Nicholas.
Yeah, who used to tell people that he tried to make his son love Schoenberg by, you know, playing a Schoenberg piece every time he was feeding the child, and the son, you know, the punchline was that the son grew to hate milk, you know, more than anything else. So there is that that kind of sort of preconception about new music, that it's something hard to listen to, it's something that you have to be very intellectually, you know, well prepared, so to speak.
You have to read some tomes.
To understand and to enjoy. But that's only one, you know, one of many, you know, aesthetics within new music. And, you know, if we were having this conversation in 1950 or 1960 or in 1970, maybe that would be the new music that we would be talking about. But since we're having this conversation in 2019, there are a million other tendencies, and you know, there's you know, minimalist music, and then there's you know, neo-romantic music, and there's neo-baroque music, and there's neo-medieval music, and there's, you know, Arvo Pärt, and there's, you know, so many things that are not, that will not fall into this description that, you know, Slonimsky referred to when he, you know, when he was trying to teach his son to like Schoenberg, right? So
why should we expect that there are this many different types of music? Does that just reflect the multicultural, complicated world in which we live in, that somehow after the 70s, that sort of like let a thousand flowers bloom? Or is there a particular reason why you think? Because I think that's a very important point about how diverse music is right now. Can you explain why it has become so much more diverse in the last couple of decades?
Well, I think it has to do essentially with the idea that there's one, you know, linear narrative, and the break of that idea, you know, with postmodernism. I mean, you can think of, you know, all the literary critics that came up with these notions at the end of the 50s and beginning of the 60s, you know, the notion that there's one line, you know, and then all of a sudden you can see that you know, that's not quite true, you know, that there's one line. There's one line here, but there are 25 different lines there, and there's lines that go backwards, and there's lines that, you know, there's spirals. There are, you know, all kinds of ways in which a certain tradition kind of reinvents itself and, you know, can refer to itself. And, you know, I mean, there was this great phrase by, I think it was Verdi, I'm not totally positive, but that said, you know, tornamo al antico e sarà un progresso, which means, you know, let's go backwards and it will be progress. So, you know, somehow around 1960, the narrative that used to be conceived as a linear narrative breaks into a thousand Non-linear songs. Yes.
It writes into 1,000 songs.
Yes.
Literally, there's 1,000 different ways of doing music. I think that's very helpful. That, and then the point that you made at the beginning to tell us all to just be open-minded to listen.
Yeah.
So maybe you want to tell us, before we turn to another piece of music, to tell us a little bit about the one we heard. That was the song that was the opening of the show today. And maybe you can tell us a little bit, given the fact that the whole world is your oyster, how do you pick out what you want to do and how did you come up with this particular song cycle?
Well, you know, one thing that I should say is that people are not just one person, as we know. I mean, you know, people are you know, these days, there's the notion that people are, you know, many different people. So I've always had at least three or four different, you know, compositional
people
inside
you.
Inside me. And
great.
one of them is I have a fascination with medieval music, and you know, it's something that I studied Gregorian chants when I was in my 20s, and you know, and this piece that you heard is based on it's a setting of a very long poem by a friend of mine, a guy called Sergio Chafik, who's one of the main Argentinian writers in my generation, but he lives in New York. And it's a poem about roosters and bones. And it revolves around the idea that what you see when you see the bones of a rooster has absolutely nothing to do with the actual rooster. But also, you know, it brings up interesting subjects, like, you know, you wake up in the middle of the night and there's this sort of semi, the light is dim, and you see this, you know, sort of grayish rooster, you know, half-eaten meal. And there's also, we did this in Buenos Aires and in New York with visuals. And
oh, that's interesting.
Yes, and, you know, with, you know, there were essentially three screens, and this particular song, we used film, you know, footage from fight, you know, like rooster, you know, fights in Venezuela, you know. So there's some of those elements in the poems as well, because, you know, the poet was a friend of a guy who used to breed,
fighting roosters.
Fighting roosters. And then he stopped doing it because he got too attached to the animals, and he couldn't see them, you know, die, you know, like for, you know, I mean, those kinds of, you know, rooster remorse, so to speak.
So that's great. And what we'll do is we'll play that song again at the end of the show for people who want to hear that again. So now we're going to turn to the piece that is going to be played on Saturday night. Now I'm going to say this wrong. Bandoneon. Is that
you said it perfectly well?
Perfect, right. Yes. And that is the name of the instrument.
Yes, it's a concerto for bandoneon. It's the bandoneon is an instrument that comes actually from Central Europe, from Austria.
Austria.
Yeah, it's a poor man's organ.
Mm.
It's a kind of a glorified harmonica. You know, and it's a devilishly difficult instrument because it has two sets of stops, you know, on each hand. It looks like a concertina, but it has nothing to do with a concertina or, you know, or an accordion.
Mm-hmm.
But since it's a devilishly, you know, conceived system of reeds that open and close. When you open the instrument, you get one note. When you close the instrument, you get a different note. It's like a harmonica, you know. When you blow, it's one note. When you and so you have each hand is one keyboard, but it's two keyboards, and those keyboards are not like a piano where you have the C and then you have the D. You know, you can have the C and then you can have, you know, a B flat right next to, you know, well, B flat would be nice. I mean, an A flat, you know, right next to the C and that kind of thing. So there's no logic. You really have to memorize these keyboards. And so you have to memorize four keyboards, actually, because it's two. Wow. Opening and two closing, and nevertheless, it's one of the most expressive instruments that, you know, that you can play. And mm-hmm. it's an amazingly expressive instrument. Mm-hmm. And for whatever reasons, at the turn of the century, when there was a huge influx of immigration in Argentina, people brought that instrument. And that instrument became the main, you know, the quintessential tango instrument.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this brings about my second personality, which is like the
okay,
the composer of tangos,
uh-huh,
so to speak.
So in that way, it seems like a very logical instrument for you to take, though you're moving it from one kind of a context. The tango dancer person inside you moves it from one context to another. Because that isn't the traditional setting you would find this instrument in, presumably, what people will hear on Saturday.
No, the thing with the tango that, you know, it's interesting for people who know nothing about the tango is that it's not just a dance. I mean, you know, it's like jazz in a way. And it started at the end of the 19th century. It had a tremendous, success in Paris during the First World War. At the beginning, it was music that was played in brothels, and then it's very much like jazz, really.
Yeah.
And then after, let's say, 1911, 1912, 1915, so on and so forth, in Paris, it becomes a society, you know, ball type.
Moves up class.
Moves up class, yeah, significantly. And there's also the function of the tango, which is interesting. I mean, it's music that you can listen to. It's music that you can sing with lyrics. But mm-hmm. it's also music that you can dance. So every decade of the century has a different, you know, overall style, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's also, you know, since you have to learn all these keyboards and you have to learn, you know, you read it like a piano. It has two staves and, you know, it's not an instrument that you have to know a lot of, you know, music in order to be, you know, all the tango players know tremendous amounts of harmony. You know, it's not like something that that comes easily, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's very it's music that it's, you know, from a theoretical point of view is very refined and it has a lot of complexity, you know.
It's, right.
So it, for a popular, so to speak, style.
It's very complicated.
It's extremely complicated. The kinds of turns, you know, harmonic turns that normal tangos have are, you know, sort of reminiscent of, you know, romantic music from the turn of the century, you know, Second Viennese School, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
so the question then is, so you've drawn from these traditions, but you have somewhat relocated the instrument, because presumably, I don't, what kind of music would the bandoneon usually be playing would not be the kind of orchestral setting that you're giving it in this piece?
Well, it would not, but there are, you know, in the 40s, for instance, there were always tango orchestras,
yeah.
you know, from yeah. the beginning of the century. And at first, you know, it's pretty much like, you know, the opera orchestras for recordings, right?
Mm-hmm.
The tango orchestras at the beginning had a lot of woodwinds and had a lot of tubas and things like that. Eventually, they started, you know, playing string instruments, along with the bandoneon. So, you know, a typical tango orchestra would have maybe two or three or maybe four bandoneons, and there would be like five or six violins. There would be a bass. There would be probably a piano. So it's a kind of a hybrid, you know.
Yes.
And there's always been some elements of, you know, Western art music instruments in the tango, you know, be it the tuba at the beginning, or, you know, the violins and the bass, you know, in the configurations from the 40s and the 50s. And then, you know, in the late 50s and 60s, there was Piazzolla, who is a very famous composer, probably the most famous Argentinian composer.
Mm-hmm.
And he went to France. You know, he was born in Argentina. He lived for a while in New York. He went back. Then he went to France to study with Nadia Boulanger, you know, like all the American composers at the time. And he was responsible for a new tango that he created that had elements of Western classical music.
Yes.
You know, it had a lot of Bartok in it, but it also had a lot of Vivaldi in it, you know. And so that became, in the early 60s, it was kind of, for a while, very novel and somewhat resisted by traditional tango, you know, lovers. But then it became, for at least 20 or 30 years, the soundtrack of the city of Buenos Aires. It became like the main...
Yes, I've
the
heard
main
him.
Tango, yes. And, you know, Piazzolla died in 92. He had a stroke, and the last 2 years of his life were, you know, he was not conscious. But he made a tremendous impact. And, you know, in the concert, at the concert on Saturday, there's a piece by Piazzolla.
Mm-hmm. And so in some ways, your piece is sort of a new version of that. You know, seeing yourself as carrying on the tradition that he does of bringing in a new instrument. And some people may be saying, maybe this is a little new, but maybe in a decade this will be, everybody will say Pablo started it and everybody's doing it now, and everybody's going to be going out and learning the bandoneon.
Lots of people are doing it. You know, in fact, in the program on Saturday, there's a piece by, you know, the soloist, J.P. Joffre, you know, Juan Pablo Joffre. He's also a composer, and he has written a piece for bandoneon and orchestra. So there are two pieces for bandoneon and orchestra, plus Piazzolla, plus a piece by Ginastera, who is the other very, very well-known
terrific
composer.
Well, with that introduction, we've got to hear this piece now, because I'm sure everybody's very interested. We'll listen to this. Is actually, we're going to listen to the second movement.
Yes.
Is there anything you want to say about the second movement?
The second movement, you know, this concerto that I wrote as a very classical concerto. It has a, you know, sort of andante, you know, moving first movements. Then it has a slow second movement and a fast third movement. You know, it's a, you know, it's like a Mozart or Beethoven.
Just
or
like a Mozart.
Yeah. Well, you know, in terms of the parts, right? So this is kind of a lyrical, slow second movement.
Middle. Here we go. So if you're just joining me now, this is Professor Jay, and we're on Office Hour today talking with Pablo Ortiz from the Music Department about his compositions and being a composer. That was really a gorgeous, gorgeous second movement there, with the strings starting, and then the very close meshing, it felt to me, between the orchestra and the bandoneon playing together. And quite, I suppose you hear this quite a bit, sort of haunting, sad, melancholic music. I thought of you as a 5-year-old with on your accordion? I don't know. Is this a childhood memory?
Yeah. Well, you know, first of all, I have to say that I was blessed with, you know, having one of the greatest bandoneon players in our time, and that's J.P. Joffre, who's going to be playing on Saturday. He played the piece. The piece was commissioned by the Santa Rosa Symphony, and it was performed a few years ago, and the conductor was Bruno Ferrandis in this, who's a French conductor in this performance. J.P. played the piece in Santa Rosa, then the piece was played in Buenos Aires, and now we're very happy that he was able to, you know, to come to Davis and play it. And he's an amazing performer, and you can feel, you know, there's something, you know, they're performers that, you know, you listen to and you feel nothing, even though all the notes are there. And there are people who can convey, you know, this melancholia and this sadness and so on. Yes. And, you know, it's definitely not only about the notes. The notes are like just the map to the treasure. But, you know, when you have a real performer, and you get the treasure.
Well, I really appreciated it this time because of your description of how complicated it is to play the instrument, and then also the level of emotion. But I am curious about this sort of melancholic, haunting sense to it, and whether you, again, in terms of how you compose, how you happen to, you said you're telling a story at the beginning. So whether you have a melancholic story that comes into your head, and then you shape it through these notes, or how does this melancholic story get written?
Well, part of the reason why there's a melancholic story is that the instrument itself, you know, is and the genre itself is very melancholic to begin with, and I think that has to do with the fact that all these people that took the instrument to Argentina were displaced people, were people who, you know, they were essentially immigrants. Argentina is a country that, you know, where, I don't know, 50% of the population is from Italian descent, and the other 50% is, you know, Spanish, Jewish, German, Russian, you know, Polish, you Just name it. So there's always this sense of being somewhere else, you know. And the country is also very eccentric. It's like in the middle of nowhere in the southern hemisphere, some 10 miles away from here, or, I mean, ridiculous distance. And but it's a country of displaced Europeans, you know. I mean, of course there are all kinds of other people there. There are horror stories of you know, original people being massacred in the 19th century, pretty much like in this country.
Yes, in here, yes.
So I think the melancholia goes with the instruments and goes with the genre. You know, it's something that it's embedded in the sound, right?
And all of those people are people who have sad stories. Presumably, they came with sad stories. In other words, it isn't just that they moved, but they moved out of, based on very sad occurrences and very traumatic.
Absolutely.
So it's the traumatic wanderer instrument.
Yes.
Because you can take it with you. You may have a Bechstein, but you may not be able to take your Bechstein with you on a traumatic experience.
Yeah.
So that becomes the instrument. So so can you tell us a little bit then about how you then composed it, and whether you picked, did you start with the instrument, or did you start with or some other level of sort of thinking melodic? It's because it's a very sculptured piece, so I'm sort of curious.
Well, usually what happens, and what I tell my students, is you have to sit and you know, close your eyes and imagine the piece. And you know, this sounds funny, but you have to imagine. I mean, you can imagine all kinds of music that is sad, music that is melancholic, music that is, you know, cold, music that is spiky, music that is, you know, like, you know, it has, you know, the quality of honey. You know, you have to kind of figure out what it is that you want to come up with. And, you know, within all these categories that I was describing, there are categories that are historical. You know, you want to write a concerto, right? So
right.
You write, you have to imagine that the first movement is going to be somewhat, you know, fast, and the second movement is going to be like, you know, slow and contrasting and maybe with some sort of melancholic, you know, content. And then, you know, the last movement is fast. So there are all these different things. You know, there's the instrument that you're writing for. There's the kind of structure that, you know, even historical structure that the piece will have, right? There's, you know, a lot of maybe more intimate things, you know, that go in the conception of the piece.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you have that, sort of basic outline of the idea, you can start, you know, experimenting with notes, and you can start, you know, experimenting with harmonies. You can begin to think the orchestration, the kind of sound that you'd like,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you would like to have for the piece.
I have two sort of follow-up questions as you talk about this. First of all, I'm very struck by your starting place as being the point of the imagination. You know, that you say you imagine the piece.
Yeah.
I think that's a very interesting way of thinking about, you know, just, I can imagine some of our listeners thinking, well, I'd sit there and nothing would come into my imagination, you know. Somehow, what is it that makes somebody able to get an idea that then turns into this gorgeous second movement? And I'm wondering maybe that was the part of you that, you know, you can't rehearsal part, you know, that when you want to try to be a performer, that part was not, you know, you had to just practice too much versus the imagination part of yourself sort of taking over and wanting to be the imaginative composer rather than the technical player.
Yeah, well, some people have both,
hmm.
you know, like, you know, up to a certain point in history, most composers were, you know, very gifted performers. You know, Mozart played the piano fantastically
yes.
well.
Yes, that's true.
Beethoven played the piano fantastically well until he stopped playing. But, you know, Liszt was an amazing player. You know, I mean, yes. So up to a certain point, you know, that imagination was, you know, went together with sitting at the instrument and practicing millions of hours, you know. I think in the 20th century, some people like, you know, J.P. Joffre, the bandoneon player, he can do both. But, I mean, most people are a little bit more removed from the matter, you know, and more sort of in this region of the imagination that we were talking about.
Hmm.
You know, it's like you don't have to be, I mean, you may have to have been a player to know enough about performance
uh-huh.
to be able to come up with something that makes sense.
Yes.
But it's like being a choreographer after having been, you know, somewhat, I mean, maybe not so great dancer. You have to know the moves in order to make, you know, something happen, right? But you don't have to be able to execute the moves yourself.
Absolutely.
You see?
Usually you can't. I mean, most of the choreographers are too old to actually get up there and do those things.
Yeah, even the most, you know, classically trained and, you know, traditional. I mean, I'm sure Balanchine, when he was, you know, his 60s, could not do what, you know, Suzanne Farrell could do, right? Or, you know, Stravinsky, for instance, was not so great a conductor, right?
Hmm.
And, you know, by all accounts, right? So, you know, but everybody can sit at home, you know, in bed, you know, and looking at the ceiling and imagine a nice, you know, bandoneon concerto.
Well, I don't know about that. Everyone is a pretty big category there, but
yeah.
at least you could. And then also when you were talking about the process, so much of when I listen to modern music, I hear echoes of what we would call classical music. so often. I'm interested in whether you think there's more of that or a great deal of sort of citation going on, reworking citation. Or I imagine maybe that's just always been a part of what composition is, because you have listened to so much music in your lifetime, and it's sort of the language out of which then when you speak from, by quoting so many different previous musical writers.
Well, that's the stuff that music is made of. You know, another thing that I tell my students is that music is a time machine. But it's a time machine because it affects the way in which one perceives time. I mean, this movement that you heard, if you like it, may last, you know, 1 or 2 minutes in your mind. If you don't like it, may turn to be, you know, 25 minutes. And it's about 8 in reality. So music is a time machine. I mean, you know, how long is the first movement of Beethoven's Fifth? You know, that's something that, you know, maybe some of the listeners could figure out, you know, and in their minds, right? And how long is it in reality?
Mm-hmm.
But then music is a time machine because it enables you to communicate with the past in a way in which very few things are able to, you know, give you that option. So when I listen to a piece by Brahms, for instance, or by Bach or whatever, I hear this man that lived, you know, 200 years ago, or, you know, 300 years ago in the case of Bach. I hear this man speaking directly to me,
mm-hmm.
and I believe that I can answer. I can, you know, establish some sort of dialogue by writing my own stuff and using some of the things that were there, and, you know, finding different solutions to certain problems, or even, you know, reminding, you know, a potential listener kind of in the same wavelength of things that I found to be interesting or to be, you know, worthy of highlighting in my little thing, you see. So I think, you know, it happens in all kinds of genres. It happens, you know, most saxophone players, you know, they introduce other standards in their solos. In, you know, let's say, you know, Charlie Parker, you have a solo that's, you know, for song A that introduces, you know, like When the Saints Go Marching In, you know, just for a fleeting instant, and then it goes away. And that's the kind of thing that people who listen to jazz are kind of trying to listen for, right?
Mm-hmm.
And in classical music, it happens all the time. And it doesn't just happen now. It happened in Beethoven's time because he was quoting, you know, Haydn, right? Mm-hmm. Not exactly quoting Haydn, but kind of following up on things that Haydn had left hanging there, right? So, and Mozart. And then, you know, everybody after that had some sort of relationship with Beethoven, you know, because he was this kind of giant. But then if you introduce all the other musics that we are surrounded by, you know, in 2019... You know, you could be quoting, you know, like, you know, anything. You know,
Chinese music,
Indian music, Balkan music. I mean, there are all these millions of influences that go into a composition.
Well, what would you point to as being particularly important for you? Obviously, you were living both in Europe, and you also lived in Argentina. So those would be important. But if you were just sort of listening to somebody who you like to quote the most, who would you say were the composers that we might listen for or to hear you having a conversation with when we listen to that movement?
Well, I don't know about that movement specifically, but there are composers from the 20th century that I'm particularly fond of, you know. Ravel is one of them.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And, you know, the concerto is a kind of a, you know, my model for a concerto is the two Ravel piano concertos, In the tango and the bandoneon idioms, I kind of stay away from Piazzolla because, you know, he's so pervasive that I try to, you know, think either before or after. You see, I'm very interested in Troilo, who was the biggest bandoneon player before Piazzolla. Piazzolla, you know, played in Troilo's orchestra, and in Troilo's idea of rubato, you know, and the way in which Troilo's orchestra moves in a style that is apparently more traditional, but it's, you know, it's incredibly modern in the way in which, you know, elastic in time. It has an elasticity that is absolutely amazing. So, I mean, it's very hard to, in that movement, you know, there are moments where, I'm also very fond of Mahler, for instance.
Now, Ravel was very interesting because it reminded me what you said at the beginning about telling stories.
Yes.
Because, you know, I think of Ravel as very much in the mode of storytelling. So since we're almost out of time, we always end the show asking our guests to leave us with a thought question. You know, what does a composer who sits down and is having an idea, you know, what kinds of questions do you bring to your work that you would share with listeners who maybe have never composed, but maybe they're so inspired by having heard this, they're going to take out their old accordion, get at the piano. You know, what are some of the thought questions you bring to your compositional life?
Well, that's a very good question. I would think more than a question. I mean, the kinds of questions that I would like to ask the people who listen to the piece, you know, what do they get out of this piece? Because there's always a difference between what I get out of the piece, having heard the piece in my mind and having heard the piece a million times when I was composing it, and, you know, going through a number of different versions back and forth, you know, deciding finally on a certain set of notes that is there, and then, you know, listening to it in rehearsals and different performances and so on. And so I have that produces a certain effect in me, right? Which is what I would like people to, you know, the reason why I'm putting this out is because I would like people to feel kind of what I feel in some way, you know. I would like, you know, but people are going to listen to this piece once, you know, with any luck twice.
Yeah.
So what do they get, you know? It's like, you know, you paint a painting on a canvas and you live with that thing, you know, for months, right? And then somebody comes to the museum and walks by and looks at it and maybe gets something, maybe, who knows? Right, so that, I think that's an interesting question. It has to do with perception, and it has to do with repeated exposure. Right.
Well, anybody who has any thoughts can find you and send you their thoughts after they hear the music.
Yeah.
And do you have one suggestion if people are interested in learning about or just hearing more or opening themselves up to modern music, and maybe they were, like you said, that they were raised by parents who made them listen to strange music. Do you have one suggestion for how to pick up and understand the world of modern composition?
Well, you have to listen to as much music as you can, and different music. All the music you can listen to, we are very blessed because we have millions of sources.
Yes.
Everywhere. For instance, you know, on Sunday there's a concert by the Empyrean Ensemble, which is our resident professional new music ensemble. And I'm not sure that it's free, but it's almost free, and it's at Pitzer. I mean,
so you can find lots of things to listen to. I certainly
in Davis.
Know.
Yeah,
Davis.
There's the orchestra usually plays a traditional piece and a concerto and a new piece.
And a new piece.
And Christian Baldini, who conducts the orchestra, has been very, very he tries to play things that are new and that are exciting and that are not, you know, like the usual thing, you know. So if you kind of look at the calendar,
see what's on. Well, that's a great way to end, saying what should you do? Go out and listen to lots of music and be open to it. So I want to thank you very much for Pablo Ortiz for coming today on the show.
I want to thank you, and it's always a pleasure to be here.
Yeah. And the show will be archived on officehourucdpodcast.com, and we will also have links to the concerto, so you can listen to that. You can hear it 7 o'clock on Saturday night, this upcoming Saturday. And in the meantime, we'll be back next week. In the meantime, stay tuned for Radio Theater, and I'll be back next week. Thanks a lot. Bye.